It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shomyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So today I'd like to introduce the Jataka tales, which are birth stories of the Buddha that he used in his teaching. And he used them as tools to teach, guess what? The paramitas, the six transcendent actions that we are studying right now. So I was excited to, I knew about the Jataka tales, but I didn't know that they were really about the paramitas. I think that's stupidly, I should have known that actually. But anyway, there they are, and we should know about them. The word Jataka literally means connected to a former rebirth. So it's usually translated as birth story, but I wish it were translated as rebirth story. I think it would help us kind of know what they are. Many eons ago, in the presence of Dipankara Buddha, a young ascetic named Sumedha made an aspiration to become a Buddha like him. And at that time, Sumedha had the capacity to achieve arhatship, which is basically enlightenment, but enlightenment for oneself. But he turned his back on nirvana in order to attain the more demanding and difficult goal of becoming a Buddha, which is enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And Dipankara Buddha confirmed that indeed, at a time in the distant future, Sumedha's wish would be fulfilled. So Dipankara Buddha made a prediction about Sumedha. And from that point, during his innumerable existences, he became, until he became Gautama Buddha, Sumedha was the Bodhisattva, which is the Buddha to be. So after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, Gautama Buddha was able to remember all of his previous lifetimes. During the 45 years that he taught, he frequently referred to his experiences, and he told stories to illustrate the various Dharma points and to encourage his followers to practice diligently. So in these stories called Jatakas, the Bodhisattva is seen cultivating the six perfections. You know, what we're studying now, generosity, ethical behavior, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. And these are qualities that must be fulfilled by every bodhisattva in the course of his or her spiritual development. But in order to be a perfection, each one must be practiced with full compassion and the most skillful means. Moreover, it must be untainted by any kind of craving, conceit, or wrong view. The latter is what distinguishes generosity, for example, the perfection, for example, from an ordinary gesture of generosity. So there's the perfection of generosity, and just we make a gesture of generosity, maybe not even knowing about the perfections. And the difference is that when it's a perfection, it needs to be practiced with full compassion, the most skillful means, and untainted by any hint of craving, conceit, or wrong view. The Jataka tale, as it comes down to us, has three parts. There's the beginning part, which is presents the occasion that prompted the Buddha to tell this particular story, like right now. Why is he telling this story right now? And then there's the story. And then after the story, as the Jataka tale is presented to us now, at the end of the story, he'll say, oh, such and such a character is really so-and-so, and that other character was really so-and-so, and this character was me. So he'll tell who the characters are as contemporaries to him right now. A point worth emphasizing that's often overlooked is that only the verses, which are not included in the tale as I'll present it, are canonical. The verses are considered to be the actual words of the Buddha. And since our version has already turned all the verses into prose, none of our text is actually the words of the Buddha. But in Pali, there are verses. In Pali, these stories are told that include verses that are actually the words of the Buddha. So that's kind of amazing. All of the Jatakas exist to demonstrate the paramitas. And I chose this particular Jataka called The Value of Friendship to exemplify the genre of Jataka tales, because this one demonstrates all four of the paramitas we've already studied: generosity, ethical behavior, joyful effort, and patience. And also it demonstrates the fifth one, concentration, that we haven't studied yet, but we will next. So as you listen to this very sweet tale, see if you can name the paramitas as they arise. I hope you enjoy this tale entitled The Value of Friendship. It was while studying at Jetavana that the Buddha told this story about having friends. Once a layman, a son of a genteel but impoverished family of Savati, sent a go-between to propose marriage to a young woman of the same class. In return, the young woman asked the go-between, "Does the young man have any reliable friends who can, on occasion, act on his behalf?" "No, madam," the go-between answered. "I don't believe that he has any close friends at all." "Well," she declared, "before I can consider an offer of marriage, he must make some friends." The young man followed her advice and introduced himself to the four city gatekeepers. After he got to know them quite well, they introduced him to the town wardens. Gradually, he became friends with some of the nobles, with the king's advisors, with the commander-in-chief, and even the crown prince, who introduced him to the king. After some time, the king gave him a position of trust, and the young man became known as Mita Gandaka, a man with many friends. Moving in these circles, it was not long before he became acquainted with the 80 great disciples and Venerable Ananda, who introduced him to the Buddha. The Buddha established his entire family tree in the three refuges. The second time the young man proposed marriage, the woman unhesitatingly accepted. The king himself arranged for his wedding feast to be celebrated under the royal patronage and presented the couple with a fine house. Everybody in the court also sent them gifts. Because of their regard for Mita Gandaka, all of the inhabitants of Savati held his new wife in high regard and felt close to her. The seventh day of their wedding celebration, the new couple invited the Buddha and 500 bhikkhus. The level of these events astonished me, 500 bhikkhus. After the meal, the Buddha gave them a blessing, and they both attained the first path. Later, in the Hall of Truth, all the bhikkhus were talking about this. Friends, one of them said, it is remarkable that because Mita Gandaka followed his wife's advice, he became a friend to everyone, received great honor from the king, and both husband and wife attained the first path. So the bhikkhus were sort of gossiping. When the Buddha heard what they were discussing, he said, bhikkhus, this is not the first time that this man has received great benefit because of this woman. Long ago, her good advice saved their family. Then he told this story of the past. Okay, so this is the first part of the Jataka. That is the occasion in the present, which explains what prompted the Buddha to tell this particular previous lifetime story. All right, now we're having the Jataka itself, the story itself that the Buddha told. Long ago, when Brahmadatta was reigning in Varanasi, there was a large lake in the jungle. On the southern shore of the lake lived a male hawk. On the western shore lived a female hawk. On the northern shore lived a great lion. And on the eastern shore, a large osprey. On the island in the middle of the lake lived a turtle. When the male hawk asked the female hawk to become his mate, she asked directly if he had any close friends. No, I don't, he replied. Most of the time, I just keep to myself. That won't do, she declared. If we are to live together, we need to have some reliable friends who can help us if trouble arises and defend us in case of danger. You must find some friends. Who should I make friends with? He asked. Well, she replied, you could get to know the Osprey King, who lives on the eastern shore of the lake, and the Lion King, who lives on the northern shore. You might also become friends with the Turtle, who lives on the island in the middle. The hawk took her advice and sought out these neighbors. Soon they were well acquainted and became good friends. The female hawk agreed to be his mate, and they built a nest in the kadamba tree on an islet in the lake. In time, they had two babies. One day, while the babies were still fledglings, some hunters from a nearby village were foraging through the jungle looking for game. Late in the afternoon, they arrived empty-handed at the lake. Not wishing to return home without anything to show for their day's labor, they tried to catch a fish or a turtle. Failing even at that, they swam to the islet and rested under the shade of the kadamba tree. Flies, gnats, and mosquitoes so tormented the men that they built a fire to drive the insects away. As the smoke from the fire rose through the branches of the tree, the baby hawks began crying. "Do you hear that?" shouted one of the men. "There are birds in this tree. Look, there's a nest. Stoke the fire. Let's roast some fowls and have our supper." When the mother hawk heard her babies and saw the blazing fire, she cried, "Husband, quick, those men want to kill our young ones. They have built a fire to roast our babies. Fly over and tell the osprey of the danger. Ask him to save our children." The hawk flew swiftly to the eastern shore and gave a sharp call to announce his arrival. "Hello," said the osprey, "why have you come? Is there a problem?" "Oh, great king of birds," answered the hawk hurriedly, "I have come to beg your help. Some villagers have built a fire under our kadamba tree, and they plan to eat our little ones." "Have no fear," said the osprey. "The wise make friends for unseen occasions, and the good must help each other in times of need. Of course I will help you. Now tell me, have the churls climbed the tree yet?" "No, not yet. They are still piling wood on the fire," the hawk told him. "Good," said the osprey. "Then go back and comfort your mate. Tell her I'm on my way." The hawk returned, and the osprey flew toward the kadamba tree to survey the scene. As soon as the men started climbing the tree, the great bird dived into the lake, filled his mouth with water, and soaked his wings. Then, as he flew over the islet, he opened his mouth and flapped his wings. The water he had brought rained down and completely quenched the fire. Startled, the men climbed down and kindled another fire, but the osprey put it out in the same way. The men refused to give up and built a new fire every time the osprey extinguished the flames. Soon it was quite dark, and the great bird was exhausted from hauling so much water. "Husband," the female hawk said to her mate, "the osprey is in distress. Go and ask the turtle to come and relieve him." "Friend," the hawk said to the osprey, "thank you for your help. You have done us a great service. My wife is concerned, however, that you are wearing yourself out on our behalf. Please rest a while. You've done more than enough." "Not at all," the osprey vehemently exclaimed. "A true friend must do all he can for his friend, even if he dies doing it." "We certainly appreciate that," replied the hawk, "but please rest a while." The hawk quickly flew off to visit the turtle. "Hello," said the turtle, "what brings you out tonight?" "Our children are in danger," the hawk replied. "Villagers are building fires to roast them. The noble osprey has been working for hours to put out the fires, but now he is worn out. Would you please come and help protect our nestlings?" "One who is virtuous gives food, help, and even his life for a friend. For you, dear hawk, I will do whatever you need." When the turtle's son heard what was going on, he cried, "Let me go, father. Your friend is my friend. I shall save those baby hawks." "That's a very good offer for you," the turtle said to his son. "But when those villagers see me fully grown, they might leave the hawks alone." The great turtle sent the hawk back and promised to be there shortly. He dived into the water, collected some mud, and swam to the islet. Crawling ashore, he threw the mud on the fire and quenched the flames. "What's going on?" shouted one of the men, surprised not to see the osprey flying by. He looked down at the fire that had just been put out and cried, "Look at the size of that turtle. He's huge. That's enough meat for all of us. Why bother with these baby hawks? Let's roll that cursed turtle over, kill him and enjoy turtle soup. The men scrambled down from the tree as fast as they could. Some began tearing strips from their clothes, and others collected creepers. They tied them to the turtle's legs, but struggle as they might, they could not roll him over. The mighty turtle was so strong that he kept crawling toward the water and dragged the men through the mud. The men refused to let go until they were in such deep water that they realized they were in danger of drowning. Finally, they gave up and clambered back to the shore, where they collapsed, gasping and coughing up water. "What a mess," one of them cried. "Half the night, a miserable osprey kept putting out our fire, and then we were almost drowned when this turtle pulled us into the lake." "You're right," said another, "but it's too late to go home. Let's build another fire and dry off. In the morning, we'll catch those little hawks and have some breakfast." As they noisily gathered sticks for yet another fire, the female hawk said to her mate, "They're determined to devour our babies. Go and talk to our friend, the lion." The hawk flew to the northern shore of the lake and landed in front of the lion's den. "Hello," said the lion. "What brings you here at this time of night?" "Great king of beasts," the hawk began, "our little ones are in danger. Men have been trying all night to catch them. The osprey and the turtle have repeatedly put out their fires, but they have just built another one. Since you are our king, I have come to ask for your help. Would you please come and save our children?" "For you," the lion replied, "I am willing to perform any service at any time. As your friend, I must protect your children. Go back and comfort your dear family. I will take care of the men. That gang of villagers must be stopped from wreaking havoc in our forest." The great lion leaped into the lake and churned up the water as he charged toward the islet. The men heard the splashing and looked to see what it was. When they saw the outline of the great beast and the light of the fire reflected in his eyes, they were terrified. "A lion," they cried, "run for your lives." They all jumped into the water and swam as fast as they could in the opposite direction. When the lion got to the foot of the tree, all the men were gone. The osprey, the turtle, the hawk emerged from the shadows and thanked him for his successful rout of the men. In a clear voice, the lion declared, "Our friendship is of great value to us all. We must be careful never to break these ties that bind us together." Working together, they put out the men's fire and each returned to his own home. The female hawk gazed fondly upon her young and thought, "Ah, through friends, my little ones are safe." Filled with happiness and contentment, she said to her mate, "What a blessing to have such good friends. It is due to the help of our friends that our children are safe and sound. Each one to do his part. Each one stayed to do his part. In our helplessness, they took pity on us, and you and our children and I have survived this terrifying night because of them. Truly, we live and prosper because we have and are good friends." These animals stayed together for the rest of their lives without breaking the bond of friendship. Eventually, they all passed away to fare according to their deserts. Having concluded his story, the Buddha identified. So, okay, now this is the third part now. We just concluded the story. And now the third part, when the Buddha identifies who played what part. So having concluded his story, the Buddha identified the birth. At that time, the young married couple the young married couple that just got married were the pair of hawks. Moggallana was the great, I don't know how to pronounce it, Moggallana was the great turtle. Rahula, the Buddha son, was the turtle's son. Sariputra was the osprey, and I was the lion. So here's the turtle, here is the Buddha remembering a previous life as a lion. He was a lion when he helped save the children of the predecessors of this current bride and groom. So he says, Bhikkhus, this is not the first time that this man has received great benefit because of this woman. Long ago, her good advice saved their family. And I always find the naming of these repetitions very moving. It's what I think make the Jataka tales in general very moving. So when I come to tell you, review the most important points, the first four are really just about remembering. The fact, you know, if you hear about a Jataka tale, you'll already know that the Buddha used them. These are tales that the Buddha, they were teaching tales for the Buddha. And what he did is he recalled his former lifetimes as in various ways, and how he embodied qualities that bodhisattvas need for their development into a Buddha. And so all bodhisattvas need to practice what are called paramitas, perfections. And the Buddha is demonstrating them by using stories from his previous rebirths to exemplify the qualities that they need, that all of his students, all of his disciples need to learn. So the Jataka tales are about the paramitas, and they're all told in three parts, as we know now, that they the Pali version includes the actual words of the Buddha, but what we have now are stories that are in prose that are made to be easily read and as interesting as possible. I think maybe some of the verses were, I hate to use the word boring, but maybe they came off that way. But finally, hearing a story that touches our heart makes a paramita that it exemplifies much easier to remember. A heart-wrenching tale stays in our minds and hearts, really, way more than a stricture like, now don't forget that generosity is a good quality. You should have generosity. But that doesn't, you know, goes in one ear and out another. But hearing a heart-wrenching tale that demonstrates generosity is much more moving and more likely to make us want to develop that quality ourselves. I like this tale in particular because hunters are the bad guys, and so what I really want to get across is that the whole tale is a skillful means for the Buddha to teach sometimes difficult to teach points. For example, when it gets to concentration and wisdom, he also used these Jataka tales. And in fact, I'm going to share with you one more at the end when we get to the wisdom paramita, which is very difficult to talk about. But there's another very good Jataka tale that demonstrates that, and I'm going to share that with you then. So these Jataka tales are skillful means that the Buddha used to teach sometimes difficult to teach points, and i.e. the paramitas, which can be difficult. But he also used skillful, actually the Four Noble Truths are a skillful means, and so are the Eightfold Noble Path. That's a skillful mean. It's skillful to teach these very precious teachings that are hard to grasp. So here are some ideas for your reflection during the week. First, do you find yourself drawn to one of the first four paramitas more than the others? Again, that's generosity, ethical behavior, patience, and joyful effort. Is one of them kind of like closer to your heart than the rest? And if so, do you feel you have a deeper understanding of that one? And the reflection for the week is, if that's so, try to explain your deeper understanding. How does that work? I know that I have, as I think I've shared, my favorite paramita is joyful effort. And I feel very close to that paramita, and I feel I do have a deeper understanding of it, actually. And that's why I'm asking this question. If there's one that is just more important than the rest to you, and if you have a deeper understanding of it, and if you could put that into words, which would help you get even closer to it. Secondly, is there one of the four paramitas that you don't have much of a feeling for? Like the second one, ethical discipline, this covers almost exactly the same territory as the 10 grave precepts, but still a lot of people have a hard time taking these in. So name the paramita that you have the least feeling for. And I wonder if it helps to see it live, so to speak, in a story. Like all four of them were there today. Did it help you to have more feeling for your least favorite paramita? And I'm giving the example of So let's say ethical discipline is your least favorite. In this story, ethical discipline becomes one who is virtuous, gives food, help, and even his life for a friend. And we saw three different versions of this lesson in this story. And if seeing that, does that help you if ethical discipline is your least favorite paramita? So that's reflection question two of something for you to think about this week and maybe even write about. Thirdly, each of us has a different friendship style. So some people have just a ton of friends, and other people have a sort of circle of friends. And other people have like one best friend. And that pattern can last your life, your whole life, all your life. I know people who just always have a big circle of friends, and others who always have like four or five friends, and others who are always have one best friend. And so what is your friendship style? And has it been true for your whole life? And are you happy with your style? So to please elaborate on that. I think that's an interesting subject for all of us to think about and be aware of. And especially if we're not happy. If we only have one best friend, but that isn't what we feel the most comfortable with. We think we should have a lot of friends. So just give some thought to that whole thing. And the fourth one is, are there other lessons to be gleaned from the Jataka tale besides examples of the Paramitas? What other wisdoms like this story that I just told you, the value of friendship, does it have other wisdom besides Paramitas? I said that the Jataka tales exist to teach the Paramitas, but they also teach other things. And so did you learn anything else from this tale? And lastly, fifth, explain in your own words what a skillful mean is and give an example from your own life for the use of one. You know, I'm sure if you're a mother, you probably have a whole bag full of skillful means to help your child learn things. And we can be anything. You know, chefs have many skillful means, not only in their cooking, but in teaching their cooking and so forth. So what is a skillful mean? And what skillful means do you use? And how and why do you use them? Well, we have lots of time for questions today, and I hope that you'll have some to ask and that you ask them, please.
So, Gail, the first question that we have is, in the beginning, you mentioned a Buddha who told Gautama in a previous life that he would eventually attain Buddhahood. Who was this previous Buddha, and were there many Buddhas before Gautama?
Yes. Okay, well, I love that you asked this question. First of all, yes, there were many Buddhas before Gautama Buddha. I know that's shocking to lots of people. Think the Buddha was the first Buddha, but the Buddha knew, was well aware that he was not the first Buddha. I think, well, I shouldn't say many. I think there were eight. I could be, it's something like that. I'm pretty, six or eight, I'm pretty sure it was eight, that there were eight, or maybe there was seven, and he, and our Buddha was the eighth Buddha. I think that's how it is. But yes, there were Buddhas before Gautama Buddha. And then this story, good for you for remembering that I actually told the whole story a while back. And I'll tell it again, just briefly. I think I told it elaborately, but so Sumedha had supernatural powers. Sometimes in our development toward Buddhahood, one stage, a pretty high stage, is that we develop supernatural powers, which means that he could fly, for example. So Sumedha had supernatural powers, and he heard that Dipankara Buddha was going to make an appearance in a certain city. And he used his supernatural powers to fly to that city so that he could be of help. But when he got there, he wanted to work as hard as everybody else to prepare actually for the amazing presence of Dipankara Buddha. So he intentionally didn't use his supernatural powers, and he was assigned the job of working on the muddy road to clear that up before Dipankara Buddha arrived. And so he'd haul away, you know, handfuls of mud, not using some supernatural power to do it all in one fell swoop. So handful by handful, he didn't finish in time. And the road was still muddy when Dipankara Buddha arrived. And so Sumedha lay down on the road himself and spread out his hair so that Dipankara Buddha could walk over his hair and not have to step in the mud at all. And while Dipankara Buddha was stepping over him, he looked down and he saw the enormous devotion in Sumedha's face. And he made a prediction that Sumedha would, in the far distant future, achieve his goal of becoming a Buddha. So he predicted that Sumedha would become a Buddha, which, you know, for the Buddha to make a prediction, it's like, well, of course this is going to happen. And so it was a very big deal and everybody recognized it. And so this was a terrific occasion. And thank you for remembering. That's wonderful. And so this was a really important story, and we actually had all heard that story before. And yes, there were Buddhas before Gautama Buddha. I'm pretty sure seven, and he was the eighth Buddha. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. The next question we have is, I didn't know that in order to be a perfection, each stance must be practiced with full compassion, with the most skillful means and untainted by any hint of craving, conceit, or wrong view. The latter is what distinguishes generosity, the perfection from an ordinary act of generosity. It would seem that most of my acts of generosity include at least something from that list. How do I ever get them to become paramitas then?
I know. It's something that we have to work really hard for. You know, there's like a thousand ways I could answer this question, and I'm going to answer it in what's coming up for me right now, which is the biggest stumbling block to for us, the biggest, I think the biggest stumbling block for changing, turning our ordinary, the best that we can do behavior, like the most generous we can be, into a paramita, is wrong view. Wrong view means thinking of ourselves as having inherent independent individual existence, as we all do. And if that feels, it feels so innate, it feels like that's how I was born. I was born as an individual, and I'm an individual, and I operate individually, and that's just who I am. And it feels so undeniable almost, that it's very hard to realize, and not only realize, but to become another truth, which is that, not another truth, that's not a truth, but the truth, to become the truth that we are not that, and we are just part of an interconnected whole continuum of life and death. We're just a part of a whole continuum that keeps moving. And we have no inherent existence whatsoever. What, there's no I here. We, it cannot be found. We're just some kind of configuration of parts. And there's no whole that is the container for them. It just cannot be discovered at all. So what we believe is just not true. And in order to make our behaviors into, in order to really practice as paramitas, we need to get rid of our wrong views. And that particular wrong view is the hardest to get over. And we still must get over it. And Zazen helps enormously, and having an enlightenment experience does it. That's, once you have an enlightenment experience, you will realize that you do not have any inherent existence. And that's what it takes. And it's very hard. It's very hard for us human beings to understand, get to that level of understanding, but it's not impossible. And many people have done it, and we're told how to do it. And in our way, in our path, the Soto Zen path, it's through Zazen practice, and increasingly intense Zazen practice. So at least we have a way, and may we all muster whatever it takes to accomplish that. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Next question we have is, what is a skillful means?
I'm glad you asked, because it's a word that we think we know what it means, sort of, and sometimes we actually don't. It's really interesting. When you think of the Buddha, just go back to the Buddha, Gautama Buddha now, and he discovered the truth of our existence, of how we actually exist. The Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, that there actually could be a cessation of suffering, which most of us still don't really get that we actually can succeed in finding the cessation of our suffering. That's the Second Noble Truth. And then that there's a means to do that. And the means is the Eightfold Noble Path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. So Buddha discovered the Four Noble Truths. And so then what? How does he get those across to like the mindset of people in India at that time? What does he do with that? And sometimes it was really hard. And so, and he was a firm believer. He was a real teacher. He taught for 45 years. Once he was enlightened, the only thing he did, somebody said, once he was enlightened, he was never alone again, not even for a minute. And that the only thing he did was teach. And the way he taught was using skillful means so that he'd come upon a person who wanted teaching from him, and he'd have to ferret out what that person was capable of understanding. And then he would teach the Four Noble Truths in whatever way that he thought this person was capable of understanding. So he had a huge bag of skillful means. So a huge bag of tricks, teaching tricks, to teach what he had discovered. And at that time, it was basically contained to the Four Noble Truths in one form or another. Later, he taught on Vulture Peak. He taught the ultimate truths to disciples who had been studying Buddhism for a long time and had attained at least like the first stage of understanding, or even more than that. And to those who were ready, he taught the ultimate truths on Vulture Peak. And those teachings are in the Lotus Sutra, and they're highly valued. And we do study them intently. And there's some other sutras also that are on that level. So he did teach ultimate truths, but not right away to the common people. And so he had to use skillful means to, in each and every situation, Buddha, but please, Buddha, would you teach me such and such? I heard that you taught whatever. And then he would teach whatever part he thought that person was capable of, and he'd use a skillful mean to do that. And that's what a skillful mean is. Now, we all use skillful means, only we don't think of them that way. You know, if someone asks you, how do you make that delicious casserole, you know, that you just served me? And the person might summarize, you know, what, oh, you just throw in this, that, and the other and bake it at 350 for, you know, 30 minutes or whatever. We develop these means to get across what we've learned and treasured. And that's what a skillful mean is. And the Buddha used them all the time. And there's so many things in his teachings that just boil down to a skillful mean. And even the Four Noble Truths themselves is a skillful mean to encapsulate so much that he knew. And the Eightfold Noble Path, even more so. Okay, thank you. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. So we're left with two questions, I think. Let me just quickly see that. So I'll ask you both the questions because we have 5 minutes left. And then you can see if you can answer them together. So the first one is that, do we need to believe in past lifetimes in order to appreciate the Jataka tales? And the second one is that in the context of the perfection of generosity and cultivating the value of friendship, how might the practice of cultivating selflessness and detachment from the outcome of our generous actions contribute to a deeper understanding of the interconnectedness of all beings and the impermanence of material possessions?
So how might the what we've already cultivated help us to embody one of these perfections? Is that basically the question?
Yes, I think so. Gil, I can repeat it very quickly again. In the context of the perfection of generosity and cultivating the value of friendship, how might the practice of cultivating selflessness and detachment from the outcomes of our generous actions contribute to a deeper understanding of the interconnectedness of all beings and impermanence of material possessions?
I'll try to answer. First of all, the first part of do you need to believe in past lifetimes? Reincarnation and rebirth is embedded into Buddhism like threads into a sari. They're actually indistinguishable. You can't understand Buddhism without an understanding of reincarnation and rebirth. They're almost the same thing, but I would say don't bother yourself about it. It's more important to work on your zazen practice. Don't bother your head about it. Just you don't need to. So I'm going to say, even though they're the same thing, don't worry if you can't wrap your head around reincarnation. Just don't worry about that. And the other question is, if you are actually feeling selflessness and the other quality that you mentioned in your practice of generosity, you are highly forward on the road toward understanding the interconnectedness of beings. Selflessness is almost the same as non-ego, and that we don't have an inherent existence. If you're selfless, then you're without a sense of I exist inherently, that I have this, I don't know what the word is, intractable bearing in the world. If you're selfless, you're without that. And so I think it's almost the same. If you're really selfless, it's almost the same as not having a belief or sense of an inherent individual existence, but you exist in the flow of all existence. It seems like that would be the same. And so that's a very advanced place to be. And to if that's your state, to continue to build on that and make it as strong as you possibly can and activate it in as many circumstances as you can, using your activating it in generosity as an example. So you're kind of well on the way, and it's really wonderful and very excellent. that you can practice that way and just go back all the time to your, as take yourself as your own example of how to behave in all other circumstances. And you're just, you know, you can't fail. You just can't fail. It's excellent. And I need to stop. And I want to thank my team and Brian and Brendan and Sahar and all of you for being here today. And all of you who listen during the week, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your attendance and your valuing these talks that I so value. And I will see you next week. Bye-bye.